You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. We're your hosts. I'm Abby.
And I'm Katie, and we're librarians at the Central Library. We've got a recording of an event featuring Appalachian music from the front porch coming up later, but before that, we'll talk about books.
All right, book chat. Katie, what did you read?
Yeah, so I actually read a nonfiction book this week. I read something a little bit different. And it's actually a true crime book.
Ooh.
So it's sort of like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, but definitely not as dark. Because this one is actually it's called The Feather Thief by Kirk Wallace Johnson. And so this one, it's sort of those books where like the truth is stranger than fiction a little bit. And like on the premise of it may not sound that interesting. It's basically somebody breaks into a British Museum of Natural History and steals a bunch of bird feathers.
Huh.
And then, you know, is eventually caught. But I think what's really strange about it is all the details, because the feather thief, the title, is actually a 22-year-old American. He's a flute player studying at the London's Royal Academy of Music. Decides to break into this museum, which is sort of in the middle of nowhere. It's an outpost of the Natural History Museum, and he steals like over $1 million worth of these feathers, these bird skins that were collected like back in the 1800s by this scientific explorer. He's a contemporary of Darwin. And so the story is, you know, this author is kind of becomes obsessed with the story, wants to know, well, why did this person do this? His name is Edwin Rist. And then, you know, how did he get away with it? Because there's still a lot of questions about how he could do this. They say that he acted alone and just had, like, one single suitcase with them. But he managed to see, like, hundreds and hundreds of bird skins. And then his investigation takes him into the world of fly fishing, which actually is pretty... that's my reaction, too. It's the idea that it's all based on the fly tying tradition.
Okay.
Where they take feathers, you know, for salmon fly fishing. And there's this... like really interesting community where they're obsessed with sort of creating back in the 1800s where the fly tying became an art form really. And so they go in and are striving for authenticity. They want to use like the actual feathers.
Okay.
Yeah. And so this is why Edwin was broke into the museum. Yeah. And so it was just really fascinating to hear about the sub-community. I've never really considered being quite that interesting. And so it was a great read.
That's cool. When you said true crime, I thought it was going to be like some heinous murder. So it's nice that it's not like a like violent thing.
No, definitely not. But still just as interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's super cool. I read something completely different. I read a graphic novel called Lost Soul Be at Peace. It came out last year and it's by Maggie Thrash. And I picked it up because Maggie Thrash's debut graphic novel was a memoir of like sort of coming of age and first love as like a queer teen. It was beautiful. So when she put this one out, I knew I wanted to read it. It's also a memoir of like her later teen years. She's dealing with depression and mental health, as well as like a feeling of estrangement from her family. So it really dives into her relationship with her father. But it also brings in some sort of, I don't want to say supernatural, but there's some like kind of fantastic elements just because that's the way she's processing sort of her mental health at that time. And it's really beautifully done. And I loved it. I would recommend it to anyone who enjoyed her debut graphic novel. But it was great. Highly recommend.
Next up, we've got a recording from a program that took place at the Northside Library on September 20th of last year. In it, you'll hear from Emily Morrison, the founder of Charlottesville's Roots Music School, The Front Porch. She and guest artists will play folk music and instruments from various places.
Good evening. Thank you for coming out tonight. My name is Evan Stankovics, Adult Services Librarian at the Northside Library. And welcome to this special Welcoming Week event made possible by the Friends of the Library. This evening's program is being audio recorded for the JMRL podcast On the Same Page, which is accessible through jmrl.org. Welcoming Week is a national emphasis on community building by getting to know each other, whether you've just come to this country or were born here. It's about extending a welcoming hand to the refugees and immigrants among us and appreciating the richness that diversity brings to our culture and community. If you would like to enter a drawing for one of these signs, which is right over there, just fill your name out on one of those white or pink slips of paper and drop it off in the red basket on Monday, September 24th. We'll be giving a handful of them out, so we'll be contacting people. So also, you should have a listing of the remaining welcoming week activities on the chairs. Hopefully everybody's got one. There's just a few left. One of the notable ones is that we're going to have a screening of Won't You Be My Neighbor, the recently released Mr. Rogers documentary, rated PG-13. That will be this Saturday at 2 p.m. Popcorn will be served, so hopefully everybody can come out this Saturday, 2 p.m. With that said, we're delighted to have back with us again this evening one of 2017's TomTom Festival Founders of the Year and founder of Charlottesville's nonprofit Roots Music School, The Front Porch, Emily Morrison. Emily is here to discuss the rich global history of Appalachian music, and we'll get to hear some samples played by our friends, too. Emily?
Great. Thank you so much. Hello. I appreciate you all being here. It is such a treat. Thank you, Evan. This is the second time we've done this, and I'm happy to do it again. I really enjoy. I am the executive director of The Front Porch, which is a roots music school. And by roots music, we mean that we are interested in and teaching and promoting and exposing the public to the roots music of what we would consider sort of modern American contemporary music. What are the roots of that? Where the strands coalesce to create what we know of as modern music? We ask ourselves that question all the time, and so we're going to talk about that, the answer to that question today. And I will say that it's complicated. It's not an easy question to answer. What are the global roots of Appalachian music? It's very complicated, actually. And we'll get into some of that today. I myself am from Appalachia. I grew up down in Ferrum, Virginia. I went to elementary school across the street from Ferrum College, which is the home to the Blue Ridge Folklife Festival. I don't know if any of y'all have ever gone to that, but it's a big celebration of Appalachian folk culture. And I grew up in the midst of that in a family of musicians and was sort of steeped in that my whole childhood. I'm very interested in it. I am not a folklorist. I'm not an ethnomusicologist. I am a teacher, and now I find myself the leader of this nonprofit, and so I do have a platform to stand on as someone who's running this nonprofit, but I'm not the expert in the room on this subject. I am a lifelong learner who has a lot of questions myself. So I'll talk to you about the things that are germane to this conversation that I find interesting. There are likely more experts in the room sitting on this side of the room as there are here. I want to take a moment to introduce my friends who will be playing music for you and talking to you about their deep knowledge on this subject. This is Bill Wellington, musician who lives on the other side of the mountain. He drove here from Stanton tonight. Let's make him welcome. Bill and Joe and Paula. So this is Joe. And then I'll introduce Seth Swingle at the end of the line here. Seth is a banjoist who is also has a lot of deep knowledge about the history of the banjo and is in many ways, I would say, an ethnomusicologist by trade, maybe not by training. Is that fair enough?
Sure.
Yeah. He spent a lot of time in Africa as well as growing up here, learning about really the history of the banjo, among other instruments, which he'll play for us today. We'll get there in a minute. So thank you all so much for being here. I want to just start by saying that when you talk about the global roots of Appalachian music, to me, this is a marriage of European music and music that came from the west coast of Africa, primarily. And what I think is received wisdom that it is a myth that I find myself continually debunking is that quote-unquote white music tends to be bluegrass, country western, country, pop country, western swing, bluegrass, and Appalachian old-time music. That's sort of white music. And that quote-unquote, and this is not in any way meant to be pejorative, but just the stereotype, is that black music is R&B, soul, hip-hop, what else? The blues.
Church.
Gospel. Yeah.
Jazz.
And that there's a pretty fine, there's a line there. And that if you want to trace things back, you go, you do this, and you do this. And that is just simply not the case. That, in fact, there are African roots very, very significantly in all forms of contemporary American music. And you can make the argument that all contemporary American music is black music. That is just the case. And so we will get into that quite a bit today, I imagine. The main thing, and so there's sort of significant factor in that. There's sort of two of them, but the main one is that the banjo, which is a kind of linchpin that we'll talk about a lot today, is an instrument that came from Africa. It has African origins, and it has evolved through the influence of African players for many years. It wasn't just simply appropriated by white slave owners. It was very gradually, it gradually permeated American music through minstrelsy, through vaudeville, through eventually country music, but it was played for a long time and highly influenced by professional African-American players. It's not so simple as an instrument that was appropriated. That's one thing I want to be clear about today. Of course, the other element of this story is the European element. And so there are many melodies that came across through Scotch-Irish settlers and also settlers who came from the continent who landed in the Appalachian region and ended up being farmers along the mountains. And that area was actually very similar to the mountains of northern Scotland, and it was felt like home to them. And many of those regions became isolated, culturally isolated in the United States. They're very poor farmers for a long, long time. And they lived on there was a cultural dividing line where their culture sort of remained separate from the dominant American culture, which allowed this sort of rich musical ground to become fertile for them. And we'll talk a lot about that today. But the main story that I think is interesting and germane to this conversation is about the industrialization, but essentially industrialization period, but also the industrialization of instruments as they were manufactured in factories and became much more prevalent in people's homes. And as a result of the Industrial Revolution, people had more time, more money to spend. They were able to actually go to shows. And that's a story that I think we can talk about today. Oh, I know the other medicine shows are the other big. So medicine shows, I would say minstrelsy, and then vaudeville are the places where that all started to permeate. So I'm going to turn it over to Seth now, if that's okay, and let him talk for a little while about the history of the banjo as it is pertinent to this conversation. And then I thought we could, everyone should feel like this is a conversation and not a lecture. But I would invite you to ask questions as they occur to you, and I invite you all to sort of chime in and help us out and say things that you think are interesting and relevant in terms of this story. Does that sound like a plan for today? Great.
So, yeah, I'll just double down on a few of the things that Emily's just said, one of which is if you have questions, please ask, because this might be the easiest way for you to get so many people that know so much about this subject in one room. And that feeds into the other comment that I wanted to make following up on Emily, which is just that the story of all American roots music, however you want to define that, is very, very complicated, almost as deep as you go. The banjo, to me, is one of the great examples of that, just because it's an instrument that crosses the color line a couple of times, kind of goes back and forth. It's been a ladies' parlor instrument. It's been, you know, a mountain hillbilly instrument. It's been the instrument of the MIT Glee Club, which you can search for online and find pictures of all these nattily dressed gentlemen, every single one wearing a tuxedo and holding banjos. I mean, the cream of American society in 1928 or whatever, all holding banjos. So, and again, I mean, I realize we're talking about Appalachian music. I'm just going to concentrate on the banjo because that's my specific field of knowledge. But people have always always, from the beginning of this music back in the early 1800s, projected their sort of stereotypes or just ideas of what this music was. I mean, it's kind of ironic now that, like Emily says, you know, the banjo is more, if you have to choose a stereotype, it's a white mountain hillbilly instrument. But, you know, in the 1850s, it would have been a black slave instrument. I mean, very much so. That was the stereotype, and there's a large body of literature. All of it kind of shocking to back that up. Yeah, so the banjo, we've been saying, comes from Africa, and what we mean by that is that there are a lot of instruments that are constructed in a pretty similar manner to the banjo that come from West Africa, and also the primary and sort of oldest style of playing the banjo is also very similar to a West African playing style, and we don't really find any examples of that in Europe, of that playing style. So most of the European lute traditions either use some sort of plectrum, a pick, or else they're twiddling their fingers like this. Some fingers are going up and the thumb is going down. But the banjo frequently is played in clawhammer style, is what it's known as now. It was called banjo style back in the 1950s or 1850s. Distinguish it from guitar style, which would have been, you know, the plucked finger style. Or people call it stroke style or any number of things, but clawhammer is a good catch-all term. And
that's see that's,
yeah, exactly, yeah. So you'll see it several times, but basically it's a downward striking motion of the hand, like a hammer. So you kind of project either your index or your middle finger a little bit beyond the ball of your fist, and you strike the strings with the nail of your finger, and then when that goes off, you get a sound. And then your thumb comes down, usually on the top string, but then sometimes striking the internal strings as well. And that playing style is really, really strange if you play any other stringed instrument. It is not similar to anything else that I know about. You don't play guitar that way, or mandolin, or lutes, or but you do play the ngoni that way sometimes, and other West African instruments. So this right here is an instrument that was probably one of the many West African lutes that all sort of mixed together and from which emerged the banjo, probably at the end of the 18th century. So this is kind of a souped-up model. Usually they only have four strings, but this one has, I think it has seven right now because one of them is broken. Yeah, this is a really, really common instrument throughout West Africa. Usually four strings, sometimes three, sometimes two, sometimes as many as eight or nine or whatever. But you can see it's a hollow body. In this case, this is made out of wood, but there are other ones that are made out of cord. And over top of that is stretched a piece of hide. And so this is very banjo-like, right? I mean, this is how you make a banjo. You get something hollow, and then you stretch a head over it. And again, there's a ton of different instruments. And another one, for example, is this right here. This is the akanting, which comes from a little bit further towards the coast. But you can see this looks even more like a banjo, right? I mean, here it is. It's round. It's got a hide head on it. It has a floating bridge. So that's something that not everybody knows about the banjo. Is that the bridge isn't actually attached to the rest of the instrument. It's just held on by the pressure of the strings, as opposed to a guitar or mandolin where the bridge is integral. So it's got a floating bridge. It's got this short string right underneath the thumb. And that is also a unique feature of West African instruments. So, again, with European instruments, you do not have a short string that you play with your thumb. This is completely other. But you do find it in West Africa. You notice that, actually, both of these have short strings that can be played with the thumb. So we have a lot of evidence that the banjo comes from Africa in terms of like the organology of the instruments. And then we also just have a ton of contemporary records of slaves playing the banjo. And it wasn't until probably the 1830s that, I mean, we have no records of white Americans or anybody else playing the banjo before the 1830s. So prior to that, it would have been all either enslaved Africans or African Americans or freed slaves too. Then then in the 1830s, a Virginian, Joel Sweeney of Appomattox Courthouse, became a huge overnight sensation, and probably the closest thing that I can think of is Elvis. I think he was kind of the Elvis of the 1830s. So to put that in perspective, he was the son of an Irish sharecropper. His dad had come from Ireland. And he was born next to the Flood estate. The Floods were quite wealthy and had a number of slaves, and he used to hang out, and one of the slaves taught him to play banjo. Fast forward 5 years, and he was touring Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Baltimore, and eventually did a tour in the British Isles, where he played for the King and Queen. He played in Glasgow, he played in Edinburgh, he played in Dublin, and he came back home with $68,000, which in our terms would be like, I don't know, $750,000 or something. I mean, he made a fantastic amount of money on himself. Plantation, I mean, that was it. And the minstrel craze began from that. Everybody wanted to go out, every white guy that wanted to play banjo went out and got one and learned somehow. And then very quickly, within less than 20 years, you have instructional manuals that will teach you how to play the banjo. And that was sort of the beginning of this thing that Emily was talking about, the minstrel show. And the minstrel show, it took a little while before the final form emerged, but basically it was a type of like amateur or professional theatrics. And usually there was a fiddle player, a banjo player, a bones player, several dancers at least, and sometimes other like fiddle or banjo players. And people would do skits. They would do like...
And something I think to think about, and maybe you can speak about this from West Africa, is that this music really comes out of a tradition of magic, a tradition of mysticism. These instruments have hide skins. These are animals. These are the strings would have been made from the guts of animals. So there's this real deep, almost Rousseau idea of the natural world and having a real vital relationship with it through this magical device. And there would have been spell casting. I mean, this was a very rich culture full of this idea that what's visible extended into this other realm. What we're talking about is this really Americanized which we become more and more materialized in the way we see the natural world and the way we see ourselves. We don't necessarily see that. I would love to speak to that.
Yeah, I wouldn't have agreed with you completely even a year ago, but funnily enough, the cutting edge banjo history research. You heard it here from what I'm saying is that here actually, at least in terms of the formation of the American banjo as it is, two banjo researchers, Pete Ross and Christina Gaddy, have just been to Suriname and brought back a wealth of new information on the origins of the banjo, and actually that's what they found, is that the banjo played a really central role in a sort of Creole ceremony called banya. I mean, the whole thing is called banya, not just the instrument. Anyway, that's kind of falls outside the scope of this talk.
It actually doesn't, I think, because of the significance of medicine shows,
which
are so similar. This sort of magical, this time when there were these people who would travel around. This is sort of pre-minstrelsy, and then it would go on through it.
Well, to me, I would think of the medicine show more as a latter-day emanation of the minstrel show. To me, the minstrel show came before
that
the medicine
can be
show.
True.
To circle back to Appalachian music, the sort of party line up until fairly recently has been that first, the banjo made it to the stage, right? It made it to this sort of higher art form. I mean, sort of. It was also a very extremely popular form, the medicine show. I mean, it's kind of hard to emphasize how popular it was. It was, in some ways, the first American art form. And it was definitely realized as that in Europe. I mean, it became wildly popular in England, for example, in Ireland, Scotland. I mean, some sort of type of minstrelsy survived in England until the 1950s. I mean, anyway, the party line until fairly recently has been that, you know, okay, the banjo was sort of appropriated from Africans and African Americans and then broadcast to America through the minstrel show, and then eventually it trickled down to, you know, the mountains as people, like, heard of what all the high society people were doing or whatever. But I think my personal feeling on the matter is that probably most people learn from their neighbors, just as they still, well, I mean, almost all folk music.
Well, one thing about the minstrel shows is they went everywhere.
And that's true.
I mean,
yes.
There was an age where
yes.
everybody went to everything.
Yes.
So there was an audience out there.
Yeah.
So you could make money, like you had circuses go around.
Circuses
were
next
everything.
Week,
the
yeah.
Vaudeville, and then next
yeah.
week you'd have the minstrel show.
Yeah.
Or the Uncle Tom's Cabin show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the environment in the Appalachians was unique in a respect. You haven't mentioned Native Americans. Okay, you had all these marginalized populations, the Highland Scots, the clearances, being forcibly removed from the land so that the lairds can run sheep on the land to feed the mills down in England, and they can stay in London and have lots of cash. Right, well, let's get these troublesome Scots off the land. And a lot of them wound up going up into the hills of North Carolina and Western Virginia. Some of them were sent, many of them were sent up as bounty hunters to kill Native people. And they would go up into the mountains and then suddenly realize, why are we doing this for the English types that were, you know, from the Charlottesville area and the Jefferson, the whole crowd that were really English. And they started sort of settling there. Saying, well, this is land that's not really policed very well, and maybe we don't have to come back. And there's a lot of controversy over the question of intermarriage between African-American individuals and Native American people. Almost any African-American family you'll talk to will have a story about an ancestor who's full-blooded Native American. You'll hear this constantly. And Louis Gates up in Harvard says, well, that's just mythology. But there's been some real new research with the Tuscaroras and some of the things where they were brought down into this part of the world from New York State. In fact, there was quite a bit of intermarriage going on. And so you have these people that are sorting out who they are and what relationship they're going to have with each other, and you have a lot of escaped slaves going up into the mountains, especially in the second when all the slaves were taken from this part of the world and taken down to Louisiana and Alabama to work there, you know, being sold down the river. Well, they literally went through the mountains, and some escaped, some got away. And it becomes this very interesting mix of people who are all sort of at odds with the dominant power structure, sorting out whether they're going to get along with each other or not get along. But somewhere in all that, I know this music is beginning to blend. The sense of rhythms is certainly. The only last thing I'll say on this is I love the fact that this is a native, as an African instrument, nobody who was being captured as a slave and sent to the United States was taking a banjo with them. It's all up here.
Yeah.
Well, but I've also heard that the slave owners, the slave ship guys, would carry instruments on board because they would let them come up at night. They found out they didn't die as much
if
they got to dance.
Yeah.
It was a money-making proposition.
Cutting losses. There was also supposedly more of an emphasis on catching musicians to bring on the slave ships, because if you had a musician, then you had somebody. And so people would just buy whatever instruments they could in port and then look around for a musician as well.
There's an interesting recording that I found as I was reading today to prepare for this that's called Black Hillbillies, African American Musicians on Old Time Records between 1924 and 1932, which is just what you were talking about, Joe. And there's 22 separate integrated recording sessions that involved hillbillies and white hillbillies, quote unquote, and African Americans who are recording music together, which goes against, again, that received wisdom that we have, that it's somehow that there are sort of lines drawn between these types of music.
Yeah, and so maybe I'll speak to that and then pass things along so I don't
Maybe play a tune.
Yeah.
If you we're all wanting you to play something.
Yeah.
Cool.
Play one of these.
Yeah.
Play one of the bizarre.
He's got to prove it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Let the heck of it.
Sorry, this one's a bit quieter than most. I'll just play a little bit here. That's a very good question, and that is one of the biggest unanswered questions of the banjo. And funnily enough, the research that I was mentioning, it's a little early to say definitively that that question has been laid to the rest, but it looks pretty good to me.
Well, you know, this book by Dean Epstein,
Simple Tunes and Spirituals,
has all these accounts of journal entries from the Caribbean, from the late 18th century.
Indeed.
And they refer to it as the banzar, the banza, the bonjour.
Yep.
There's about 30 different banjolo.
Banjar.
Yep.
And in fact, in Thomas Jefferson's journals, it's called the banjar, not banjo.
That's something that we don't think about so much now. I mean, the Caribbean is not a huge part of mainstream American culture anymore, but certainly was at one point.
It was about 10 to 1 white to black in the continent, but it was about the other way around in the Caribbean islands.
Exactly. Also, you know, the Caribbean was the big stop-off point before slaves came to America, so typically people would come across from West Africa to the Caribbean, and then, you know, slaves would be kept there for, in some cases, a number of months, maybe even a year, before being shipped up to wherever they were going, down to Brazil or up to the States or whatever. This is also an era when land travel was not a winning proposition. You really, if you were going long distances, you wanted to be on board ship. And also, America was still part of the British Empire at that point, so all I'm trying to say is there was a huge amount of traffic between the few settled parts of America, which were all along the East Coast, and the Caribbean. And so the Caribbean was a much larger part of the sort of formation of the banjo than we would think now.
Can I just add one quick thing, which is that one musical difference between, or I would say one formative difference, is that Africans were allowed to play drums in the Caribbean were not ruled by Great Britain. So American slaves were not allowed to communicate with each other with drums. So that's a very significant sort of turning point in the evolution of music. And as you can hear, in Appalachian music, even today, there is very rarely are drums played. The way that African slaves made up for that was by using their voices. American slaves used their voices. They would often use bones. They would use whatever they could, and they would dance. So they would do ham bone, which has a lot of different names, where they'd use their bodies as percussive instruments. and use their voices as expressive instruments, whereas their music largely had used drums as expressive, communicative purveyors of information and of dance and song. And so if you think about Caribbean music, it's so rhythmically significant, right? And the banjo was actually, it is a melodic instrument that was primarily used as a rhythm instrument and for a long time.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
No. No,
I disagree with
that. just in that, the drum thing, yes, not being a, being more of a rhythm instrument, I would say that's more of a modern idea of old-time music.
Okay.
You know, the we have, again, to complicate things, in Dina Epstein's book, which if any of you guys are just riveted by banjo history, the next thing to do is to go out, and they may even have a copy of it here at Northside, look at this wonderful book by a woman named Dina Epstein called Sinful Tunes and Spirituals, Black Folk Music to
Up to the Civil War,
yeah. And it's a wonderful book. It's the sort of foundational text of banjo research. And it's this lady, a research librarian from the University of Chicago, alma mater. Anyway, she was not allowed to be a professor because it wasn't really a time for ladies to be professors at that point, but what she was very smart and very dedicated. For whatever reason, she got interested in the banjo, and in her capacity as a research librarian, corresponded with all of her friends who are research librarians, and they all sent her everything that they put on the banjo, and she made this corpus of just every single reference to the banjo ever, up until the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So all of these unpublished manuscripts, little novellas, correspondence of every variety, newspaper clippings, everything that spoke about the banjo. One of the things she... something that was mentioned frequently were these giant meetings in Congo Square. You can still go to Congo Square down in New Orleans. And in Congo Square in, 1785, there would have been thousands of black Africans engaged in ritual practices on Sunday, all Sunday long, from dawn until dusk. And they were doing it to banjo and drum. So there were troops of banjo players, a dozen, two, three dozen banjo players at a time, and drummers. And they're all doing some sort of ceremony or social gathering, or who's to say, but I think it probably goes back to this sort of bonza religious ceremony, which apparently still exists in Suriname, to circle back to your question. This is truly, this research has come out in the last 6 months, and I'm not hugely up on it, but seemingly... the word banjo probably comes from bonza, is the way it's pronounced there. And it's a sort of play-acting and also ritual ceremony, which still survives in Suriname and possibly some other places as well. And funnily enough, it doesn't refer to the instrument, it's the ceremony itself. And so, playing, like if you played the banjo at the ceremony, it would be playing bonza, but you can also sing bonza, dance bonza, and all of these other things. So... I think that is the best answer that we have so far as to where the banjo comes from, but this is a question that people have asked for.
So drumming was allowed in New Orleans because it was not part of the
it was French
United
colony.
States.
It was French,
yes.
Yeah.
And so the Deep South...
French and Spain.
Yeah.
There was
no prohibition about any of that stuff.
That's right.
Indeed. And so there, one of the many very interesting points that Dina Epstein makes that, again, just complicates our view again and again and again of what this music is that down south, the fiddle really wasn't as prominent as it is in Appalachia. For us, the fiddle is like, particularly these days in old-time music, the fiddle is really it's the boss instrument. It's the one that carries the melody. It's sort of the virtuosic instrument. It's been that way for a long time, but it wasn't really the case down in Louisiana or Mississippi or whatever. There's a tradition of drumming there as well. Hill Country Blues, if any of you listen to that.
I'm going to take it back in history to the 1970s. Now we're really going back. Okay? Because I'm not a historian. I've run a museum. I started a museum, in fact, in Beckley, West Virginia. My mother was a history teacher. but I stayed in college for 3 months and decided college and me in 1968 weren't going to get along. There was too much going out in the world that just fascinated me, and there were too many mistakes for me to make as a young man yet. And so I sallied forth and made bunches of them. But I traveled across the country in a school bus, and I did the back of the land hippie things. I was from the city. I was from Paterson, New Jersey, kind of a real tough inner city, and my father died when I was very young. So I wound up fetching up into central West Virginia, Gilmer County, buying an 80-acre farm with a house and three barns for a grand total of $6,000 in 1970. One traffic light in the whole county, and it just by luck or happenstance, that county, it was the host of the oldest folk music festival in West Virginia. And so these people would come from all over the world, not just the United States, who knew that this music being played at this festival was, from their viewpoint, the real deal. This was the music that had come down directly through families, and with the stories that would come with them, Elsick's Farewell, Flannery's Dream, all this great story lore, which I fell in love with as much as the story lore as I did with the tunes themselves. But what that music was for us in our 20s, hippies, you know, we were called the hippies, you know, people that were, well, they're not really from here. But what was it about that music? Well, this music, Appalachian music, as we discovered it in the 70s, was clearly a kind of trance music. Now, we weren't doing, you know, Hare Krishna thing, but we weren't too far away from that. So when we would play in these jams, where you had the fiddle and the banjo, this combination of these rhythmic elements playing this older music. See, we call it now old-time music, as before bluegrass. And for a long time, I just used the word old-time, meaning, oh, that's the old music. And only in the last couple of years, I've really began to understand, no. It's about the old-time, a consciousness that's pre-industrial. It's about when things ran on a different time relationship to life. They did not run on clocks and machines and gears. They ran on the sun and on rhythms and on streams flowing or not flowing. When you would play, and this is still the case for us today, if we'll go to a festival and you'll play for hours and hours all day long and you're with your friends and you're camping and you're playing, sometimes 1 or 2 o'clock at night you're playing, you punch through to another place. There's no question. And everybody knows when it happens. It's not like somebody says, boy, that was kind of cool. We're all looking at each other going, whoa, we're there. We're not in this time anymore. We're outside of time. And this is why my fascination with the banjo and these older traditions that really are steeped, all music, I think, is ultimately steeped in spiritual practice going as far back as you can go. But we forget that, and then we rediscover it by each generation. So
that's a great segue to have you pick up your instruments and play for us. So.
Okay. Yeah, we'll play.
Let's do that.
Okay.
$495.
Yeah.
And you were frailing, but you were not.
I was not. I saw that. I saw that.
He also has a resonator on the back of his banjo. You want to talk about that, just the sort of last piece of the banjo evolution?
Sure.
There is so
much to say about the banjo. I'm missing a couple other crucial steps, but you can see this here, for example, is a gourd banjo, which was probably the earliest form of what we would call the banjo. That's not, you know, an African instrument that looks kind of like the banjo. This actually is a banjo. And then about, this is something you probably could have found in the late 1700s, and then by the time you get to the, around the turn of the century, the aughts and the teens, you get banjos that look like this, sort of different. This one has got a back on it, so you can see this is a closed back banjo as opposed to the open back banjo there. All this does is just makes the thing louder. Yeah, as you may have noticed.
And redirect the sound forward.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yes. So instead of half of the sound being lost in the ballet of
the
banjo.
All
player,
the bands were getting louder and louder with horns being added to them, so you had to counteract.
Crank it up.
Get louder.
Yeah. Yeah, and many people play the old time music.
Well, damp down
because of the volume and the way they blend together, you get a punchier sound. In some ways, too, you have this is a plastic head, very stable. So at a festival, you're not constantly retuning. A skin head, really does respond. But at the same time, they're bright and they have that sound, so dampening it gives it more of that old sound. So, you're always tweaking it. This pot, well, you can tell about the pot to show the evolution real quick. But the pot and the neck, just how that all evolved.
Well, this is a W.A. Coles pot. So this comes from probably 1910 out of Boston. But the neck is a new neck out of China. But it's a White Lady Eastman neck. So this mine's kind of old and new. Combined hybrid.
But because her arms are short, she bought this neck from China that's a little bit shorter. So the reach for her is a little shorter and was much more comfortable for her. So, this thing's always evolving.
Yeah,
I love
Pete Seeger, he had the really long, long.
He's a tall guy.
Yeah, we can have another whole conversation just about Pete Seeger, actually, and his influence on modern American music.
Or we could play another tune.
Do. Please do.
Okay. Play a Mozart tune?
Sure.
The fiddle has a always a troubled, weird relationship within the society, and the fiddle particularly is considered quite a destabilizing force. you don't get your work done as well if you're fiddling, you know, you're not. And then if you keep people up late on Saturday night, they may not show up on church on Sunday morning, so you're kind of in competition with the local preacher. So then you start getting all that stuff about the diabolical side of the fiddle. Fiddle also creates that trance, that rhythm, you know, gets the blood going, and the dance. That was often what you needed for courtship in a rural area. There was no other place to meet young ladies and young men and go ahead with a thing called sex and then have children, you know. I mean, that's kind of what we do. And the fiddle played a very big role in that. So you have all this stuff going on with that. But we do associate it almost exclusively now, this fiddling, with white culture. Marianna Giddens talks quite a bit about when the black slaves were often the gifted musicians that would play at the big house and would play Scottish airs and reels and strathspeys for the dances. And so if somebody was a fiddler and ran away, that would be the first thing on the runaway poster. You know, Henry or whatever has a violin, plays the violin. It was a real marker as to who that person was and their value to their own. So very complicated history. Boy, I just jumped through it.
No, it was great.
Well, I think that's, to me, it does have a magical sound. I mean, almost a sound you can't resist. It's quite incredible to be around, I mean, really great fiddle players who are just, I mean, it can just make you, it does something to you to really hear people play. And I don't know about you guys, but I one time, you know, I didn't grow up listening to music, really. I didn't find out about old-time music until I was in my 20s. I started playing fiddle, and I didn't play very much, but I went to a gathering, including some people like Tom McCreesh, who went on to play in a really great band, and a couple other people who became pretty famous. But it was just at a gravel pit after a fiddle contest in Vermont, and they played all night long. And I didn't know there were so many tunes, and they were so rich, and it just kind of rang my bell, and I was like, oh, now I get it. You got to play this thing, because it was a really magical, almost completely irresistible thing.
Well, there's a very different sound. Fiddles vary in sound dramatically, and some are just, you know, full-throated sounding fiddles, and some are really very, you know, thin but sharp sounding.
One of the great things is you could, like, one of the sort of unspoken rules of old-time sessions is usually a one guitar, one banjo. You can have five fiddles, mm-hmm. but the banjo is such a distinct rhythmic sound within the mix that, well, it's not written in stone, but it's often that way. That if there's one banjo player, that's plenty, you know.
Yeah.
And but the child ballads were collected in America. A lot of them were found in America. Cecil Sharp did some collecting. There was a collector from UVA named Alfonso Smith who did a whole lot of collecting.
Yeah.
And found, for example, like in the child ballads of the 305, 38 of them are about Robin Hood. And all we know about Robin Hood really comes from these ballads. There's no tales of Robin Hood. It's the ballads of Robin Hood that we know about. Well, in America, there's only one person who was ever collected singing Robin Hood songs. And they were from Harrisonburg.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, I'll sing a child ballad for you.
Awesome.
But I have plenty of banjo.
Now,
you all know this one. I know you all know this one. Do the devil and the farmer's wife. Okay, there's lots of different subjects. In fact, the first one was called The Devil's Nine Questions.
Oh, I love that.
The conversation between the devil and the person. You must answer my questions nine, sing 90, 90, 90. But this one is number 278. Which means it's getting kind of late. But you remember that song, "A Devil Went Down to Georgia"? Well, the idea of a devil and a mortal competing is very old in folklore. And so this is another example. And this song has a chorus, so you can all join in. Your part goes, "Hi, diddle-i, diddle-i, hi, diddle-i, diddle-i, day." Let's give it a try. Hi, diddle-i, diddle-i, hi, hi, diddle-i, day. Well, there was an old man lived over the hill. If he ain't moved away, he's living there still. Hi, diddle-i, diddle-i, hi, hi, diddle-i, day. Well, the devil went up to the farmer one day, said, "One of your family I'm going to take away." Hi, diddle-i, diddle-i, hi. Don't take my eldest son. There's work on the farm that's got to be done. Yeah, but you
You can have my nagging wife. By heaven, she is the curse of my life. So I threw the old lady on his back, carrying her off like an old miller's sack. He brought her around down to the forks in the road, said, old lady, you're one devil of a load. Of hell, he says, smoke up the fire, boys, we'll roast her well. Ten little devils come rattling their chains, she upward and slipped her foot and knocked out their brains. 100 little devils come running through the door, she upward with her foot and killed 99 more. Come peeping on the wall, he says, take her back, daddy, she'll murder us all. Well, that farmer, he thought things were pretty good back home. He's just sitting down to read the paper one night. He looks out the back and says, oh my gosh, she's bringing her back. Well, that farmer went to try to hide under his bed, but she yanked him out by the hair on his head. Now this proves that the women are better than the men. They can go down there and come back again. Almost to go to show what a woman can do. She can outwit the devil and her husband too.
We're going to try to redeem the relationship between man and woman at this point.
Oh.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Then you got a lumberjack.
We, I guess we're at our 8 o'clock. All of you came here, obviously, for some reason. Is there any question that you have that we haven't answered or anything that you would particularly like to know?
Well, Appalachia is a particular place. It has a geographical domain. I'm just curious whether there are things that lived entirely in that domain that you consider to be Appalachian music, or how has the world, the geography of the music broken down, being, you know, Appalachia runs from Ohio to Georgia, or something like that.
When I first started playing old time music, it was in Vermont, and there were no banjos. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody was playing clarinet or banjo, especially for country dances. So I think the banjo really defines.
But do people call Appalachian music something different? Same music, but call it something different when it goes out of the region?
Old-time music is, nobody says I play Appalachian string band music anymore. At least.
But that is what it is. Appalachian string band music is what old-time music is.
So the name's just disappeared as being rooted in Appalachian.
String band, I would take.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but, well.
And these are the oldest mountains. As you know, the oldest mountains in the world. There's something in these mountains. And again, this connection to the natural world. Very briefly, we're in Italy and we're trying to speak or understand what people are saying. We're speaking English, we speak no Italian, but we're listening to people speak to us in English but with an Italian accent. And it's very intense, you know, as you're learning this. We've been there a whole month. One day I got up out of the house and I went outside and I was listening to the birds. They were singing. I swear to God they were singing in Italian. I mean, really, the birds were like, it was just like the Italian I was listening to. And I think we don't know it, but we're always mimicking the natural world. This is really where we are. And so music, I do believe, is informed by the geography. And we feel that we're free of geography now. We're so, you know, we can get influences here. We can talk about medicine shows and minstrel shows. And I think that all is true. But there's something that comes from the place that keeps moving, almost like Ray Bradbury, you know, when they go on the Martian Chronicles, people establish themselves a colony on Mars, and before they knew it, they start turning into Martians, right? The place does inform, and I think we should be open to that marvelous thing.
I was just reading in a book that said the Appalachian Mountains were formed when Africa bumped into North Carolina, into North America, when the tectonic plate, and so it was like that. I was just reading in a book this last week, and it had that thing where that's how the mountains were formed. Was that the continent of Africa and North America were bouncing off of each other before the tectonic.
The mountains of Scotland are an extension of the
Yeah, right. So
that's
it could
right.
be.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's exactly
it's all poetry.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you, Evan, again for hosting and organizing this. And thank you all so much for sharing your expertise.
So how great was that?
That was a lot of fun. Really enjoyed getting to hear from them. So that's all that we have for today, but we'll have another recording from a library event for you in 2 weeks.
This podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org.
If you'd like to recommend a title for us to read and discuss, you can reach us at podcast@jmrl.org. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast to make sure you don't miss a single episode. And that's all for us today. So thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be
on the same page.